It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Dallas Hubbard likes that cruising has returned to downtown Princeton.
People aren't scared to walk up and down the sidewalks now. We got the rejuvenation of the theater. The Sarvers have bought Jimmy's restaurant and going to redo the restaurant. The red building on the corner is going to be a new city police substation. All the artists are at work beautifying the whole street. And this isn't just about Mercer Street. It's about the town of Princeton.
The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. Federal, state, and Kanawha County health officials met yesterday in U.S. Senator Joe Manchin's Washington, D.C. office to pin down plans for more studies on the January 9th chemical spill at Freedom Industries. As Dave Mistich reports, the announcement comes as a relief to those who've been pressing for this development since almost day one.
Officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Institute of Health, and the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources were part of the meeting. The CDC denied requests for animal studies at the end of June, but Dr. Raul Gupta of the Kanawha Charleston Health Department reports the National Toxicology Program will spend $750,000 to over $1 million on the studies. He says they'll take up to a year to complete and will address health implications on humans of the spilled chemicals. Gupta says that while the CDC's early drinking water standard was sufficient at the time, he's been calling for more information since the earliest moments of the crisis. He says the manufacturer's studies on MCHM exposure were for industry and regulatory purposes only and should not be applied to human health.
We need to make sure that while these initial industry data was adequate enough initially, because that's all we had to develop a screening level, you know, on an emergency basis, we must go back to the laboratory.
Gupta points to studies conducted by his own organization, as well as the DHHR in conjunction with the CDC. Studies that show that somewhere between 1 in 5 and a third of residents affected reported health symptoms related to the spill.
Lots of data and studies have been established since that demonstrate that it seems that significant exposure may have happened. In that light, what we have been talking about is having some way of having a surveillance system in place that will take into account the long-term impact, if any exists, on human health.
The CDC is also committed to visit West Virginia within the next 2 months to start crafting a long-term health monitoring program. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
If you spend any time at the West Virginia State Capitol during the annual 60-day legislative session, you'll notice many voices clamoring for the attention of our state's part-time lawmakers. All citizens are welcome to approach legislators with ideas and requests, but average citizens generally don't have the time or the know-how to impact state policy decisions. One grassroots initiative has been working to change that, as Sarah Lowther Hensley reports.
In Lewisburg, Clarksburg, Hurricane, and Martinsburg, citizens are meeting this month to celebrate policy success, learn how to advocate for the issues they care about, and craft initiatives to champion in the upcoming legislative session. The Our Children, Our Future Regional Policy Workshops, co-sponsored by the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, the West Virginia Healthy Kids and Families Coalition, and the West Virginia Community Development Hub, are an effort to build momentum and consensus for this year's legislative agenda. The initiative casts a wide net to solicit ideas, narrows the focus to a manageable list of priorities, and then works collaboratively to engage state government officials. Chris Kimes is political director for the West Virginia Healthy Kids and Families Coalition. He says these workshops provide an avenue for people from around the state to learn about the issues, get energized, and to believe they can participate in the process.
As an active community member, I can come learn the skills that I need to begin working on policies and actually learn about specific policies that groups are thinking about advancing in the next session.
And they have experienced success. This past year alone, 7 of the group's top 10 priorities became law or were implemented into public policy. Funding was restored to family resource networks and other programs that help children and families. The minimum wage was increased. The State Board of Education approved a policy to increase daily physical activity in public schools. A pilot for a parent mentor program was launched. Cities and counties will now have a new tool to combat the problem of abandoned properties. New protections for pregnant workers were put in place. And the West Virginia Future Fund was established to set aside a portion of natural gas severance taxes to create an endowment fund. Senate President Jeff Kessler says his hat's off to this group, whose grassroots groundwork can be a real help to lawmakers as they try to stay in touch with the needs of their communities.
I represent 110,000 people in my district. I can't shake all their hands and ask them all face to face, but when you get having a series of forums throughout the entire state where people that do have issues can come forward, present them, collect them, and put them in some type of rational agenda that we can now understand why they're important. You know, sure, it helps to pass a NIT policy and pass legislation that does have a direct and immediate impact on improving the lives of our people and our community. So, yeah, this is the way to get it done.
House Speaker Tim Miley agrees that it's an effective approach to advocating for public policy issues.
So they have learned to come together as a large group with various interests but a common theme to strengthen our communities. And by doing so, they have created a very loud voice in Charleston for the legislators to hear and listen to and recognize by way of their agenda items. And so it's very effective.
Not all of the group's initiatives made it through the process, but Kimes says even in defeat, there are lessons to be learned. That's the case with last year's effort to pass a prescription pseudoephedrine bill, and that group of citizens will try again.
We literally were outspent there. Big Pharma came in and made their voice known. But an interesting thing about that is just last week at Lewisburg, that team is back again. And they've learned from those lessons, and they're gearing up, and they're broadening the base and getting more people involved in the discussion. And I think they may have a better try at it than this next legislative session.
Two workshops remain, Thursday, July 24th in Hurricane and Tuesday, July 29th in Martinsburg. Organizers say walk-ups are welcome. On September 9th and 10th, groups from across the state will gather in Charleston for a policy symposium. And in November, this year's legislative agenda will be set. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Sarah Lowther Hensley in Clarksburg.
And for more information, visit our website, wvpublic.org. Yesterday, we told you about a new program helping the state's military veterans get back into the workforce in a way that can also be therapeutic. The Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program was created by the legislature earlier this year. Today, we're introducing you to a veteran who says the program has given him a second chance at a normal life. Ashton Mara reports.
Here, sing your Frozen song.
Let it go, let it go.
Eric Grandin is the owner and operator of Sugar Bottom Farm in Clay County. I met him and his four-year-old daughter for lunch at one of those small-town diners where everything is homemade.
You want carrots and corn?
Grandin is a disabled Army veteran, serving for 20 years on 6 tours of duty. He suffers from PTSD and was deemed unemployable by the federal government after a flashback in 2011.
I was dealing with a lot of pain, and it sent me back to my days at Desert Storm. I worked for an interrogator team at the 18th Airborne Corps Enemy Prisoner of War Camp, and it's just kind of related. And sent me back to February 25th, 1991.
As a patient in the hospital, Grandin says you couldn't make him believe that 20 years had already passed and he was no longer in a war zone.
And another therapist came in. She asked me what I was doing. And basically I was standing at the wall and just working with my hands. And I told her I was doing the mission board, which is what I did. I worked operations also.
Grandin had multiple responsibilities during his military career, but part of it was to interrogate prisoners of war. He says he did not torture POWs, but used some severe techniques, like preventing them from sleeping for long periods of time. When he retired from the Army in 2009, he showed no signs of mental distress to his family. Grandin says he hid it until that incident, until his life changed. After 2 years of being hospitalized on and off and receiving therapy through the VA, Grandin was introduced to James McCormick, an Army vet himself. McCormick was awarded the Purple Heart, multiple times, also suffered from PTSD, and was starting a movement that today is the West Virginia Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program. Grandin got involved in the program early on.
You know, he showed me that there was something else. You know, and that's what the second chance was. And that's what made a world of difference. And
since, Grandin has turned his family garden into a profitable farm, selling at area farmers markets and even to the State Department of Education for their farm-to-school program. But more than that, Grandin says farming and beekeeping have become his therapy. He no longer needs to see a doctor. Beth Ann Earle, a Navy vet who helps run the Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program, says that's the experience a lot of their participants are having, finding solace in an unsuspected place.
I actually had a veteran say to me he'd been homeless. He'd been an alcoholic. He'd been drinking and whatnot. Trying to recover, trying to reestablish, failing time after time. And it wasn't until he went to a farm, he went to a retreat, he went somewhere, and he went out and he was working, planting and cleaning a garden. And he says when he picked up the dirt and he rubbed it all over his hands and arms, he says it wasn't until then that the blood came off his hands.
Earle says that was a powerful moment for her. It showed her just what this program could do for the more than 100,000 veterans living in West Virginia. But why? Why is farming, beekeeping, raising livestock, why are they such therapeutic endeavors for these veterans? I posed the question to Grandin.
Purpose. I have purpose again.
The Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program has helped dozens of veterans so far across the state transition from the military to careers or just hobbies in the field of agriculture. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
You can find more information about the West Virginia Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program, including how to get involved, on our website, wvpublic.org. This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:42. Rain and thunderstorms in our forecast today. Heavy rain is possible. Temperatures will be in the 70s, becoming partly cloudy overnight with lows in the 50s. Sunshine on Friday with temperatures remaining in the 70s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by the High Technology Foundation, headquartered at the I-79 Technology Park in Fairmont. Online at wvhtf.org.
For the fifth time in 8 years, the Marshall University Forensic Science Graduate Program earned the highest overall test scores in the country. Clark Davis has more on the number one ranking.
The Marshall Forensic Science Graduate Program attracts students from all over the country. Take, for instance, Mackenzie Kilcary, whose fondness for forensic science started with a weekly viewing of a television show. Here's the theme from NCIS. It's one of the many programs on TV that have produced what the forensic science administrators call the CSI effect.
I think that sparks a lot of people's interest in the forensic science and kind of gives you a perspective on what we do. And yeah, NCIS was one of my favorite shows when I was a kid and I still watch it. But it is very different to see how different, you know, this experience is. You can't just go into the lab and 20 minutes later everything's done. But I think it does play a role in how important forensic science and the different fields of forensic science is.
By the time students get to the graduate program, they realize the field isn't as simple or as quick as the way the shows make it look. It's one of the reasons why the field is growing. Lauren Waugh is an assistant professor that teaches forensic chemistry.
I see in lecture very often when I'm teaching a concept, especially recently with Breaking Bad, because I teach all about drug chemistries, I would get many hands raised and say, that's not how they did it on Breaking Bad. You mean they were wrong? And, you know, it was kind of, they were joking that they, yeah, we understand that this is not the correct way to do things.
Each year, the American Board of Criminalistics offers a test for graduating seniors. Marshall students captured the first and second rankings for highest overall test results among 202 students from 16 other forensic science programs that participated. Of the top 26 highest test scores, 6 were Marshall students.
I definitely think that that number one ranking allows us to attract very high quality students. Whenever employers see that Marshall University Forensic Science Program master's degree from us, I think it has a little more weight for them. I know our employment rate for our students is outstanding, greater than 95% within the first year of graduation.
Students in the program go into fields that examine DNA, work in digital forensics, examine drugs that come in as evidence, work as toxicologists or trace analysts that study gunshot residue or even fire debris. Terry Finger is the director of the program. He says because of the CSI effect and other factors, the field is growing and becoming more competitive.
There's a lot of competition. As the CSI effect has taken hold, many universities have developed these programs. So in order to be highly competitive for these positions, we have to have a high ranking amongst many. And that's essentially what we've achieved.
Finger says they encourage students to take their knowledge upon graduation and work in the state. But he says so many of the students are from all over the country, so they prefer to take their experience back to where they're from. And that's what Mackenzie Kilcary, a native of Plattsburgh, New York, hopes he's able to do through connections he makes in the program.
Marshall graduates have jobs all around the country. So I know I mentioned to her that, hey, you know, maybe I'd want to end up in Boston. She's like, oh, I have a contact. She pulls up her sheet and she gave me the contact. So I think that and just, you know, knowing the second years and knowing them very well, I think there's a lot of networking opportunities.
Or maybe they'll work for NCIS. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
A summer event in Princeton is trying to resurrect a pastime that was all the rage 20 or 30 years ago, cruising. Drivers used to flood the streets of southern West Virginia towns on weekends, meeting up with friends and family. Now, the Princeton Cruisers Reunion is bringing back those. And as Jared Klein reports, locals think it's also helping revitalize downtown.
If you drove down Mercer Street in downtown Princeton on Friday or Saturday afternoon during the 1980s, you'd see people working away, washing cars and mowing their lawns in preparation for the evening's cruise. When things got started, the streets were packed bumper to bumper with cars of all makes and models. It wasn't about the speed, but the quality time. Police began to discourage cruising, though, when they started getting noise and traffic complaints. By the early 2000s, the practice had been completely abandoned. Since then, Mercer Street has gotten a reputation for crime. Princeton Police Chief John Howell explains.
Since the cruising stopped, and, you know, the downtown area kind of went down and started losing a lot of businesses, and which caused the crime rate to go up some.
But now, cruising seems to be making a comeback. For the third year in a row, some of the same people who packed the downtown scene decades ago gathered in Princeton last weekend to celebrate a blast from the past. Cars from as far back as 1975 and as recent as 2007 lined the streets hours before the event. Despite the rain, music is playing and people are out right before the cruising begins. Tim Howard will be driving a 1975 MG Midget. He grew up in the area and says the new energy is a metaphor for the town's revitalization.
It's just a great feeling, you know, this town kind of died away and now it's coming back. And this is what's making the town come back. It's bringing people to downtown and bringing all the hot rods out and cars that we saw go away 20 or 30 years ago. We're bringing them back out.
But cruising is about more than just cars. It's also about the tradition and memories. In fact, it meant so much for one couple, they decided to say their vows during the event.
I grew up on these streets up here cruising town back in the mid to late 80s in the heyday of the cruise. And it got stopped for a long time when they brought it back. She had the great idea of getting married up here during the middle of the cruiser's reunion.
That's Dallas Hubbard. He and his wife Tanya were wed just 2 hours before the event began at the Dick Copeland Town Square. The couple's wedding attire was adorned with orange flames to match the ones on the black hot rod they took cruising after the ceremony. The group says the cruisers reunion is just one of the positive changes in the town.
People aren't scared to walk up and down the sidewalks now. We got the rejuvenation of the theater. The Sarvers have bought Jimmy's restaurant and going to redo the restaurant. The red building on the corner is going to be a new city police substation. All the artists are at work beautifying the whole street. And this isn't just about Mercer Street. It's about the town of Princeton.
Two more cruises are planned this year. for the third Saturdays of August and September. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jared Klein in Princeton.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.